Hi, everyone. This is Martin Willis, your host of Podcast UFO. Welcome to episode number 7. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/podcastUFO. You can listen to us on your smartphone on Stitcher. We have a free app right on our website, which is podcastufo.com. And if you listen on iTunes, please give us a rating there as well. We are accepting guest blogs, and as always, we encourage you to interact with our guests. You can go to the interactive menu on our website, check out our upcoming guests, and on that page, you will see how to interact with them. Today, it gives me great pleasure to have physicist, author, lecturer, Stanton T. Friedman. If you ever watched any documentaries on TV or online about UFOs, you probably have seen Stan. He's a great guy that gives a lot of integrity to ufology, and I was thrilled to have him on this show. This is part one of part two, and part two will be posted sometime in late May. And here's our show. Hi, everyone. I have the great, the one and only Stanton T. Friedman on the line. How are you doing, Stan?
Very well, thank you.
And we're calling you up in New Brunswick, yes?
Fredericton, New Brunswick, 73 miles from beautiful downtown Houlton, Maine.
Oh, I do know where that is. That's at the end of nowhere.
I-95, the only quiet part of it is from door up to Houlton.
Right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. It's a real real honor. And, you know, I've seen about every film that you've been in that's G-rated, I should say. You have been in so many different documentaries, and you've done over 700 lectures. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, only in all 50 states, 10 Canadian provinces, and 18 other countries. I get around, yes.
Yeah. Now, you became interested in UFOs in 1958, and I read this from your bio, and began lecturing in 1967. So my question is, what sparked the initial interest?
I'm cheap. I needed one more. I was ordering books from Marlboro Books in New York, mail order place, discount books, and I needed one more book so I wouldn't have to pay shipping $1. And there was one, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects by Air Force Captain Edward J. Ruggles, who had been head of Project Blue Book in the early 50s. And I figured, what the heck, it was marked down a hardcover book from $2.95 to $1, which tells you how times have changed. And our contract, I was working for General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department, and it was a joint effort of the Atomic Energy Commission and the United States Air Force. So they were funding half our work. That year, we only spent $100 million, incidentally. It wasn't a small program. We had 3,500 people, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. Anyway, so I respected the Air Force. Second, my mind, gee, maybe if these things are real, and I didn't have an opinion because I didn't know anything. That's not popular these days. You're supposed to have an opinion whether you know anything or not, you know. I figured if these things were real, then maybe they're using nuclear energy and that would help our program, you know. And the third was, what the heck, it'd be worth a laugh if nothing else, if it was real bad and wasn't costing me anything, because that would have been the shipping cost. Anyway, I got the book, I read it, I was impressed, not thoroughly convinced, but intrigued, and shared it with a neighbor. I was 24, Charlie was 10 years older than I was. He was an engineer, and I respected his opinion. And he was more impressed than I was, which encouraged me to look further, and moved off to California. I set a record, I think, for working on canceled government-sponsored advanced research programs. Not intentionally, you understand. Moved to California, had a good librarian, read 12 more books or so. Some of them trash, and if I'd read them first, I'd probably never read another one. And then I made a shocking discovery about 1960-61. At the University of California Library, I found a thing called Project Blue Book Special Report Number 14. And there were a couple of surprises. One, it wasn't mentioned in any of the books that I'd read. A little weird. Two, it was a huge supply of data, more than 50 charts, tables, graphs, and maps. I was in data heaven. And three, the press release was with it. A guy named Dr. Leon Davidson, who was working at Los Alamos, had managed to get a copy of this thing and so issued it with the press release. The Secretary of the Air Force lied through his teeth. That shook me up. I mean, working under security, you sometimes tiptoe around the truth so as not to reveal classified information. But here was the Secretary of the Air Force saying, quote, on the basis of this report, we believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available, unquote. The only trouble with that very straightforward statement, it was a total lie. The unknowns were 21.5%. That's not a round off of 3. They did a quality evaluation. The better the quality, the more likely to be identified. We're talking about 3,201 cases now. We're not talking about a dozen, two dozen.
No.
3,201. Yeah. And they had a rule. No sighting could be labeled as an unknown unless all 4 of the final report evaluators agreed it was an unknown.
Really?
And they asked an obvious question. Is there really any difference with all this data they had between the unknowns, the only ones we're interested in, and the knowns? And so they looked at 6 different observable characteristics, current size, color, shape, speed. They did a chi-square analysis. Anyway, what they found was the probability that the unknowns were just misknowns, we missed the boat here someplace, was less than 1%. Now, these data somehow got left out of the summary. And we still hear statements from the nasty, noisy negativists imply that the only reason science can't be explained is there wasn't enough data. They had a separate category, right? Or insufficient information. There wasn't enough data, by definition, not being unknown. So that report shook me up. I joined Pro and NICAP, two old groups which don't exist anymore, to get their newsletters. Talked about it at lunch with my brown bag buddy scientists and, you know, keep up with what was going on with no particular attention to go public. I had a job. I had a security clearance, a family, a mortgage, et cetera. Moved to Indianapolis, worked for General Motors on what turned out to be another government-sponsored program. Got to know Frank Edwards, who lived there. He was a journalist. He knew everybody, radio, print. And Frank came out with a new book, Flying Saucers, Serious Business. It was a bestseller. Mm-hmm. And he sent me a copy. And by this time, I moved to work for Westinghouse Astronuclear Laboratory and another big program, which eventually was canceled. And I called Frank. And I said, Frank, I like the book. I want to go public. You know everybody. Give me some names. And he did. One of them was the producer for a radio talk show with a group named Contact. How do you like that? And so I called. And I was a little surprised. The guy didn't seem to be interested. Don't call us. We'll call you. And I was surprised because in Pittsburgh, being a nuclear physicist for Westinghouse, which has several nuclear divisions there, those were gold-plated credentials. You know what I mean? You go in to borrow money. How much do you want? Because you work for Westinghouse, you're privileged. Anyway, surprising as it may seem, the guy called me less than a month later at 6:30. Could I do the show at 7 o'clock, please? Somebody had canceled. Okay. I've often wondered how many other calls that he made, how far down his list was he going.
Where are you
but
on
I
the
lived,
list?
Yeah. I lived near the station. So I said, well, yeah, sure, why not? So I went down to the station. And that was my first of many appearances on KDKA Pittsburgh. It's the biggest station in town. And somebody at work at Westinghouse heard me on the radio, and her book review club was reading Frank's book. Stan, you think you could give a lecture to my book review club? Sure, why not? So my first lecture was in her living room. It was very well received. I did the program many times more, and was beginning to like this lecture business. And one day, Sibity, I'll tell you, that's the story of my life. I'm riding to work. I live downtown Pittsburgh, and Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab was in a small town called Lurg, out of town. And my car was in a garage, so I was driving in with Joanne, who had a PhD from Carnegie Tech, supervising us. And we're talking, and I said, yeah, I'd like to speak at Carnegie. He says, talk to the dean. I said, well, Joanne, I talked to Dr. So-and-so, and he wasn't interested. She said, Stan, the dean's my husband. He's heard you on the radio. Give him a call. Okay. That's insider. So I called Jean, as it was, and, oh, yeah, I'd love to do it. So we figured out a date. It was during the day. And he finally says, bottom line, how much do you want? And knowing I'd have to take some time off work, I was reaching for the stars. I said, $100? Sold. And then, as I knew his wife, he told me what he was paying the other speakers in the series, $1,500, $1,800.
Oh, no.
Jeez. Well, I learned an important piece of information, because I spoke, it went extremely well, we had a great crowd, and he was kind enough to send a very nice letter to the agent through whom he had booked the other speakers. And that guy booked me at a milestone talk for me. I was working full-time at Westinghouse on nuclear rockets. They booked me at the Hearing Society of Detroit. $300 expenses. Wow. You know, so I go up there. It turns out they were sold out 3 weeks in advance for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk.
Wow.
And there wasn't one negative question. Now, nobody could say the Engineering Society of Detroit is a bunch of nut books or quacks or anything like that. They're pretty down-to-earth guys up there. So that's inspired me to do a lot more speaking. And finally, I go to my boss and I say, look, I'd really like to do more Latin. On the other hand, I have a wife, a child, a mortgage, a clearance, so I don't want to endanger anything. I need some ground rules. What can I do? What can I do? So he goes to his boss, and he comes back with some rules. First, you can say whatever you please on your time. You can identify yourself as a Westinghouse nuclear physicist. Third, we'd like you to start with a disclaimer that says the views you're about to hear are mine and mine alone and not by my employer. Now, who could ask for anything more?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did ask for anything more because I got a call from a colleague at Los Alamos National Laboratory. They were building nuclear rockets as well. And we'd had contact about building for nuclear rockets, pretty esoteric. He says, Glenn says, Stan, how about speaking to the local section of our American Nuclear Society? Well, I was a member of the American Nuclear Society. I said, sure. No, I mean, I'm the expense account, Stan. Whoops. I'm in Pittsburgh. He's in New Mexico. I say, I don't make those decisions, Glenn. I talked to my boss, and he talked to his, who fortunately had heard me speak to a joint meeting of AIAA and IEEE, two engineering groups, societies, a full house and no negative questions and everything. And they said yes. So believe it or not, I went to Los Alamos on an expense account for the explicit purpose of giving a lecture, Flying Saucers Are Real, to the Los Alamos section of the American Nuclear Society. We had 500 people there, again, no negative questions. No secrecy. In other words, I didn't say, oh, I'm going on a trip to talk about radiation shielding.
Mm-hmm.
No, I was going to give a talk. The enthusiastic response of my professional colleagues really got me going. And when the bottom fell out of the advanced nuclear and space systems business, as it did, I went full time. And I've been at it ever since.
Wow.
I'm going to retire, but maybe when I get to be 80, I don't know.
Now, did you ever get any ridicule from fellow employees at all?
No. As a matter of fact, it was the enthusiasm of the professional people. I've given over 700 lectures, as I mentioned, and I've only had 11 hecklers, and two of them were drunk. And one, just to illustrate, was at the Gulf Research Labs in Pittsburgh. And it interrupts me three times. I said, I'll talk about that later. You know, why don't you talk about this? Why don't you talk about that? Finally, the boss, which is a dinner and a talk, the boss is sitting next to me, says, hey, let him finish. So I finish, and I turn to him, and he says, well, I'm sure one could come to different conclusions than the ones you've come to. So what I said, look, as I recall, you hadn't read any of those five large-scale scientific studies that I mentioned. I describe this study, show a slide, tell people what's in it, and I casually ask, how many of you have read it? Mm-hmm. You know, I really get 2% who read any of them. And I said, as I recall, you hadn't read any of those, right? Well, yes. Well, that's the difference between us, isn't it? I give you my conclusions. I give you the sources of evidence on which I base my conclusions. You have read none of them. Whose opinion is worth more? Long silence. So, no, it hasn't been a problem. I'm told you'll get more hecklers than that in that number of lectures if you talk about sports, religion, politics, whatever.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
You know, what happens sometimes is people will reveal their interests that they hadn't told anybody about. I remember two guys coming to my lecture, and they're talking to each other. I didn't know you weren't Bill. I didn't know you were interested, Bill. Oh, I've been a member of NICAP for years. They hadn't talked for ridicule. And I know that that's very important because at the end of my lectures, I normally ask, I'll say, look, I get the first question. How many of you believe that you have seen what I would consider to be a flying saucer? I've defined my terms earlier on. And we didn't let the CIA in. It's okay. I'll make a little joke. I'm just going to point and count. Mm-hmm. And I do that, and the hands go up very reluctantly. They know I'm not going to laugh. They're mm-hmm. not sure about everybody else, you know. So I point and count, one, two, three, four, five. By the time I get to the other side of the hall, the hands go up vigorously. Each one thought mm-hmm. he was the only one, you know.
Yeah.
Finally, it turns out about 10% believe they've seen one. But then I ask, how many of you reported what you saw? 90% of the hands go down. And right. if there's any left, I'll say, how many of you were in the military at the time? If still anybody left, I'll stick my neck out and say, you want to tell us about it? One guy in front of 1,300 people had a great line. He says, I can't. They told me not to say anything.
Wow.
And another guy said, they took my pictures. And he stopped. So I waited a moment. I said, look, I'm not asking you to stand up. I'm asking for identification and stuff, but I'm sure the audience would like to hear the rest of the story. He remained seated. People clapped. He remained seated. Flying a four-engine airplane for the Air Force out of the Pacific, daytime, gets a call on the radio, plane 20 miles ahead of them, flying saucer heading your way. They had gun cameras. They took pictures of the base to which they were flying to let them know that they had intelligence stuff. The crew doesn't handle it. That's special stuff. They land, the film gets taken, they get briefed and told never to say anything. And I'm sure there wasn't anybody in that room who didn't believe that this guy was telling the truth. I mean,
right.
he was not looking for PR or anything. So right. what I've found is I am not a masochist. There's a whole chapter in my book, Flying Saucers in Science, about public opinion polls. And then there's the non-believers. And so people say to me, you must get it hard about it. They must give you a hard time, Stan. I said, no, they don't. I come on very strong, no question about it. But what I find is that people are shocked by the data because nobody's told it to them before.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like that data from Blue Book Special Report 14. And furthermore, what they really want to know is the why questions. Hey, it's clear that these things are real, as you say. Why the cover-up? Why would aliens come here anyway? Why don't they land on the White House lawn? You know, mm-hmm. to these sorts of questions. And let's face it, when you've been asked questions like that, you get to thinking about them. And so you can't say, well, I'll give that some thought back to you tomorrow, not when you're in front of 2,000 people at a big auditorium. And I've spoken to as many as 2,000. So that I find that people really are curious. They're ready to accept.
Mm-hmm.
Now, occasionally, the one you asked about a professional colleague, have a lecture at a college in New York State. Guy gets up in the question and answer period, and there's no written questions or anything. First guy that raises his hand gets to ask. So I call on him. He said, great way to start. He says, I've never heard so much nonsense in my life. Mm-hmm. Great way to start. So fortunately, I had a good answer. I couldn't have told you what it would be if you'd asked me in advance. I said, can you be a bit more specific, please? Well, you said that Betty and Barney Hill were taken to Zeta Reticuli and back in 2 hours. I said, no, sir. What I said was they were taken on board a craft for 2 hours. They didn't go anywhere. He gives me a second and third. You said that equally nonsensical. So I corrected them. And finally the fourth one. And finally somebody else in the audience shouts out, how about taking some sense of this guy gets up, walks out. Well, wasn't drunk. And I said, I'll answer your question, but who was that? Obviously, I had gotten under his skin. It was a professor of physics.
Oh, really?
He didn't hear what I had to say at all. You know, he expected me to say some things. And yeah, there are occasions. I give a lot of afternoon talks on campus, you know, physics seminars and stuff like that. And once in a while, one of the students will tell me, you know, Dr. Jones thinks this is a bunch of movie. So I make a habit, sneaky, I guess, of thinking about things, and I'm almost certain they don't know anything about. I'll describe the nuclear rocket engine, and you're all familiar with this, aren't you? And nobody is, of course. And I'll get into the electromagnetic submarine, good physics topics. And then I set them up. I said, a question for you. What's the numerical value of 1G, as in 1G acceleration? Everybody says 9.8 meters per second squared. I said, well, that's right, but we don't measure anything else that way. What units can you use that would... It was like I was talking Swahili. So I said, well, 1G acceleration is 21 miles per hour per second. So if you've got a car accelerating at 1G, at the end of 3 seconds, it's going 63 miles an hour. And it's a pretty hot car, because it usually takes 4 or 5 seconds to get to 60. Mm-hmm. And then I say, what's the value of the speed of light? 300 nanometers a second. I said, again, we don't use that those units for anything else. And 670 million miles an hour is the speed of light in rational units. And I say, the next question is, and this is a multiple choice question, you don't need to do any calculations. How long does it take 1G to get to the speed of light? It's a multiple choice question, 1,000 years, 100 years, 10 years, or 1 year. How many think it's 1,000 and go down the line? There are plenty who think it's 1,000 or 100 or 10. Some who think it's 1, and it is 1, only 1 year.
Wow.
But the whole point of this exercise is to get people to look at the world in a way which allows them a perspective about all this stuff. You know, if it took 1,000 years to get to the light, it sounds like a difficult trip, to say the least. But 1 year, we've had guys in space for 6 months. You know, geez, it would only take 6 months to get close to the speed of light. So I do try to stall the idiotic questions. There really aren't many. So when I surprised a newspaper group, chairman of it here in Canada. They were having a meeting in St. John, New Brunswick, which is 60 miles away. Hey, Stan, heard you on the radio the other day. Could you speak to our group? Sure. Well, he sent me a letter. Never seen so many newsmen change their minds about something as rapidly as they did. They just hadn't known that there was all this data, facts. And so I figure I've got a winner. You know, I've been lecturing since 67, so what's that, 45 years? I must be doing something right. So I don't worry. I do give advice to people who say they want to start speaking and stuff. I say, look, there are a couple of rules. Never lie. And be prepared. Do your homework before you go out there.
Yeah, I've noticed that on a couple of debates with you I wanted to talk to you about. But one of the things that I was I changed my mind about a person on was I watched the Larry King when Bill Nye the Science Guy was there, and I walked in when my son was watching him. And I thought, oh, that guy's great. And then I watched him on that, and I think, what? I got to say, that guy was an a-hole to everybody. I just couldn't believe it.
Well, he was. And, you know, one of the crazy things on that show, he brings out a document that's got one line blocked out. He said, these guys say that there's a cover. There's no cover. That's just personal information where the guy lives. And I fortunately had my book with me, and I managed to turn to the page that has a CIA UFO document there, which is all blocked out, six words. And I said, that's not the way it is. It took me 5 years to get this CIA top secret Umbra UFO document, and it's almost all blacked out. I've got 156 NSA UFO documents all whited out. There is cover-up. I was just lucky I had the book, and I could turn to that page real quickly, you know. But, yeah, so on one of his shows, said that the 10 missiles, the minimum missiles that went down, oh, it was just a power failure up at Malmstrom Air Force
right.
Base.
Yeah.
It's pretty redundant power, for God's
That's
sake.
That's right.
You think we're, you know, somebody kicked the extension cord, you know.
You couldn't do that if you tried. You know, no one could do that if they tried, really.
And another example, he said Roswell was a skyhook balloon. Mm-hmm. Well, in the first, I tried to, this was not on the air. That's the way it was. Well, it turns out no skyhooks were launched at the time, or had been launched at the time of Roswell. Secondly, these huge polyethylene balloons, big teardrop-shaped balloons, you know, mm-hmm. gigantic. Well, the Roswell balloons, even if you believe the Air Force, were small, standard balloons that you could buy at a Play store these days, you know, a few feet in diameter. They were neoprene balloons. And as a matter of fact, when they're out in the sunlight and it gets pretty hot in New Mexico, they turn to dust practically in a couple of weeks. Polyethylene is much more resistant as it happens. But I mean, this was Bill Nye, the science guy, and I got a note from his ex-wife is saying that, you know, he probably spent at least 5 minutes on the internet before doing that program.
That's perfect.
So,
yeah.
Well, you know, I did Larry King four times. Can't do him, but because he doesn't have a show anymore, it isn't fair.
Yeah. No, it was great. I was so glad that he was doing that. Speaking of Roswell, you were the first one basically investigating that, and there's some great people working on it now. We had a guest formerly, and he'll be back, Don Schmidt, Tom Carey. What's your opinion on that? Do you think the truth will ever be revealed, or would it have to be the government that comes through and admits
obviously,
the truth?
Most original witnesses are dead.
Right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
we're talking 7. It may be as a result of something else entirely. A Hollywood company, Stellar Productions, has option for making a movie, Top Secret Magic, M-A-J-I-C. My book, Top Secret Magic, and Don Schmidt and Tom Carey's book, Witness to Roswell, the idea would be to make a dynamic sort of documentary, the ups and downs of UFO research, partnerships that break up and things that go wrong and stuff like that. And the screenplay's been written. And now the point is to find somebody with a few million dollars he wants to spend to make the movie. In charge, well, there are two guys. The joint producers would be Bryce Zabel, who's a Hollywood mogul, if you will, president of one of the unions and stuff. And Donnie Moe, who you remember from Happy Days?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He's into film production, too. And so we hope that the movie would be, you know, like All the President's Men. Mm-hmm. You know, a little JFK thrown in for effect. But the good, the bad, the ugly, and so forth. I hate to admit it, with my name on 5 books, which were all listed at my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, more people watch movies, read books.
Yes.
Terrible thing to say, but it's true, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So, that movie could produce, you know, a real feedback. Now, there's a second movie that's just been optioned. I signed the contract on Saturday. for the book captured the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience by myself and Kathleen Marden, Betty's niece, mm-hmm. who did most of the work on the book, and the same outfit. And so, you know, we can have a dynamic duo of movies that shake up the world. Who knows?
Yeah,
hope
I was
still around when they get made.
Yeah, me too. I grew up in the Portsmouth, New Hampshire area. Now, what was the original film that they did on that? That was back in the 70s or something?
There was a movie in 1975 that Universal Studios did for NBC, mm-hmm. starring James Earl Jones.
That's right, yeah.
And Estelle Parsons and Barney Hughes. And I was a consultant on that movie. I was living in Southern California. Would you believe they got my name from the Air Force?
Wow.
I think funny. Mm-hmm. So my name's Earl Jones and was at the set and so forth. And it wasn't a bad job. Now, our book, Captured, really focuses on what went on after the first book came out, how Betty's life was changed, Barney's life. He didn't live very long after that. She went through some ups and downs, seeing UFOs everywhere and then nowhere. And Kathleen was very close to her. She had a really close connection to the story. The day after it happened, Betty called her sister, Kathleen's mother, mm-hmm. not too far away in New Hampshire, and told her all about the case, and Kathleen was in the room. And a few days later, the family went down to see Betty and Barney. Kathleen saw the car with the strange spots that reacted to a compass being placed near them. And so, you know, Kathleen went through ups and downs about her views about the case. She was only a teenager at the time. But in the last several years of Betty's life, Betty's been gone now for several years, Kathleen wanted to check to see, was this story true or not? So she transcribed all the hypnosis tapes, which she owns, incidentally. She's a custodian of Betty's estate. Their University of New Hampshire Library has a whole section that's a repository for a lot of the Hill materials. And so very careful effort to find out what's going on. And I was very impressed with all the work she did. And she came to me partly because I was the first guy to publish the star map, but Betty had once said, if there's one guy you can trust, it's Stan Friedman, because I had met with Betty several times, done television shows, been in her house, and so forth. So Kathleen and I wound up doing this book, and we've had a good response to it, and I just found out the e-book version has sold 12,000 copies
wow.
in a very short time, which will make more money from that for sure than from the first cover.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, you know, UFOs are a funny subject. Libraries will tell you, I've been told this anyway, that it's one of the subjects they can't keep the books on the shelf. And I remember a school librarian told me that, and I said, what's the other one? She said, sex, and for high school students. And, well, the kicker is, both subjects are ones that it's hard for you to talk to somebody about. Well, you know, think about it,
yeah.
A teenager, and so forth. So we know, and I always confound people who bring me in to speak, because they'll say, well, there's not many people interested in this, Stan. You know, I don't think so. And I've given them instructions on how to publicize my lectures, and they're always astounded. We have full houses. I've had 2,000 people in a lecture.
Yeah.
And people have sent me letters saying it's the biggest crowd we've had for this kind of a presentation. Because, you see, if it's sponsored by a university, and if they have highlighted my background working for GE, GM, Westinghouse, et cetera, well, he can't be a nut, can he? I suppose mm-hmm. he could be. At least people presume that. And the thing that the campuses find is they get so many people from off campus mm-hmm. to come to my lecture. So, you know, I know the interest is out there. And, you know, how do you tap into it? Well, a movie might do it. And, mm-hmm. you know, if anybody put, you know, half the money that went into blowing the lid off the political Watergate into blowing the lid off the cosmic Watergate, you can do it in a year. And what people don't realize is the press hasn't been doing its job.
That's right.
For example, I know of no major publication that is focused on the words of General Carol Bolander. He was an Air Force general who got asked in the summer of 69, what should we do about Project Blue Book? Because the Colorado study, the Condon Report, had recommended it be closed earlier that year. And the Air Force needed an opinion from somebody who wasn't connected with it, you know. And now, General Bolander was an engineer who worked on the lunar excursion module. And we landed on the moon successfully, and as he told me when I spoke to him years later, no more 12-hour days, thank goodness. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he wrote a memo which wound up closing Project Blue Book at the end of 69. And in this memo, which we didn't see for 10 years, got it almost by mistake. Somebody made a big request under Freedom of Information, got a whole bunch of stuff, and this was there. Anyway, in it, he says, reports of UFOs which could affect national security are made in accordance with JNAP, Joint Army Navy Air Force Publication 146, or Air Force Manual 55-11, and are not part of the Blue Book system. Two paragraphs later, he says, if we close Project Blue Book, the public won't have a place to report sightings. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security will continue to be investigated using the procedures established for that purpose. Now, that's remarkable because the Air Force has been saying for umpteen years that Blue Book was the only group that was concerned with UFOs. Well, I managed to locate, when I got a copy of this memo, to locate General Bolander. And I said, gee, you know, I told him I'd had a security clearance and so forth. And I said, it sounds like you were saying that there were two separate communication channels. Yes. Huh? In other words, if a saucer goes down the runway at a strategic air command base where nuclear weapons are stored, that's a national security problem.
Absolutely.
If you and I go out at the end of my driveway and fight through the snow and see a saucer going over, it happens everywhere, all the time. No big deal. MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, incidentally, has for over a year been getting over 600 sighting reports a month.
Wow.
A month.
That's amazing.
And I get people saying, I haven't heard anything about UFO sightings recently. Well, they've been going on. You know?
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is what Bolander alone said is a major statement, because if you read what the Air Force sends out to people, you know, we closed Project Blue Book, we have no connection with it, there's no national security problem, blah, blah, blah. Well, and they'll tell you that no sighting report evaluated, investigated, collected by the United States Air Force gives any evidence of being a threat to the security of the United States. Well, what if any of those three functions were done by somebody else? And it would still be a true but not meaningful statement. Mm. They say there's no evidence of technology beyond our knowledge. Well, no, of course not. I've worked on fusion propulsion systems and a study thereof that will get us to the stars. Worked on fission rockets, incredibly powerful little monsters. You know, we know about technology. That doesn't mean we've built them yet. You know, It doesn't take long, as it's been known, but it doesn't take long for a major media group, if they want to dig into this. And it's one of the things we hope comes out of the movie Magic Men, M-A-J-I-C. Mm-hmm. And, you know, finding people with guts enough is the problem. I need to tell you, the press is in trouble, print media.
Oh, yes. You know, it's dead.
Because
yeah.
The internet and all the other things going on. So they don't have much money for investigative journalism other than looking at other sites on the internet, you know, which, mm-hmm. much of which is garbage. But it's not that big a deal. And I think, frankly, if we were to make an all-out effort, for example, to get amnesty for those who learned about UFO stuff while working under security. I mean, maybe say you go back, it had to be more than 25 years ago, something like that. It'd be flooded with reports.
Oh, yeah.
Now, there are some people saying that, oh, the Secretary of the Air Force, Sheila Widnall, said anybody could talk about Roswell. No, she didn't. What she said was that anybody who thought what they learned was classified could talk to Colonel Weber about it. He wrote that first report the Roswell report, Truth versus Fiction in the New Mexico Desert. He provided the fiction, unfortunately. She said that they could talk to him because he had clearance for all the special clearance programs. She didn't say that they could talk to anybody else. So that would be one step. And also have a collective, a central collection point. When I'm living in Southern California, I get a call one Monday night about something seen Sunday night, a red light over a highly populated area, about 9 o'clock on Sunday. I mean, there should be a lot of people around, beautiful weather. I didn't think too much of what am I going to do with a red light in the sky. Well, I get another call the next night from somebody who'd seen a red light in the sky, same time, looking from a different direction. I thought, well, let's do something about this. So I called the local paper and said, you know, I'd like to have a letter in there saying people can send me their information and stuff. Oh, sure, send us a letter. So I did. Gave them a telephone number, a post office box, you know, no email back then. And witness names won't be used without permission. Mm-hmm. Anybody else who saw. And I didn't give a lot of details. I got 30 responses by phone or by letter. And people were so relieved, and many of them were with a lot of other people. They tried to call, the cops. What are you drinking, lady? Uh-huh. That was the standard response.
Right. Yeah.
And one of those people had binoculars and could tell me that it was a plastic bag and a little frame with a candle inside. He told me where it came down, and I checked the Wilshire Country Club, and I talked to the fire chief, and yes, they were not about to go public with it. The reason being, they didn't want every kid in the neighborhood to try to do that. They're fire hazard. Mm. It gets very dry in Los Angeles. Mm, this was
right.
Like in March. And you know. So what I'm saying, though, is a little effort to get more responses from people really made a difference. And it's like the America's Most Wanted television program.
Right.
You got enough people looking, you greatly increase the chance of somebody finding the guy you're looking for. I mean, going up and down your own street isn't going to do you much.
Mm-hmm.
So a movie could help do that. And so, or a media person who really wanted to do it. Hey, there's a role for Larry King. But you see what I'm saying? That
right.
The
yeah.
data is there. I know it's there. And people are reluctant, but if you make the circumstances correct, they would like to see this mystery solved. And there's something else that's happened, drastically changed. The Kepler satellite.
Mm-hmm.
Now people
are
planets.
Yeah,
planets. Remember, 40 years ago, we didn't know of any other planets. What do you mean? There's nobody out there. There's no planets out there. Well, what I mean is we can't see any out there, whatever. Anyway, it's only looking at a small chunk of the sky. If you hold your arm at arm's length and make a fist, that covers the area of the sky it's looking at. They can't turn around and look all over the place they want. On the basis of the data they've already obtained, they're now talking about there might be 100 billion planets in our galaxy.
Mm.
100 billion. Now, Frank Drake of the SETI effort, silly effort to investigate SETI, you know, was saying a few years back that there might be as many as 8,000 places in the galaxy that could be sending radio signals. Mm-hmm. Why anybody would send a signal to a primitive society like ours, which has only had radio for 120 years, I have no idea, using technology appropriate to us. I mean, I don't
use
the slide rule anymore.
Yeah.
You know, most of us don't use vacuum tube radios anymore.
If we were 1,000 years advanced, we probably won't be using radio signals anymore either.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So, but the whole point is that people are now saying, geez, got to be a lot of guys out there, you know, not just us. And what has happened is we've gone from Ptolemy, who said the Earth is the center of the universe and all the planets and stars revolve around the Earth. And you can go outside and see how they're moving around us, can't you?
Mm.
Anyway, along comes Copernicus, 1543, and he said, sorry, the sun is the middle. The Earth and the other planets go around the sun. Now, he had the good fortune to die the year in which he published that book, so he wasn't burned at the stake. figures later, Giordano Bruno was. The church banned his book for 300 years because man was the center of the universe and the church is at the top of the heap. Well, now we realize that Copernicus wasn't right either. And so our insignificance is coming into the fore. As a matter of fact, in the Brookings study done way back in like 1960, impact of contact with extraterrestrials, they said one of the groups that would be most impacted would be the engineers and scientists whose, you know, being at the top of the heap suddenly is going to look not very appropriate. And I think they're right. Arrogance and ignorance, that's what I find when I deal with the noisy negativists.
Now, do you think a lot of that, you know, I've thought about this, do you think a lot of that has to do that there's no grants available for research in UFOlogy or any of that?
Well, that's part of it, and they're afraid of losing their grants. There have been a dozen PhD theses done on the subject, although you'll never hear that from any of the noisy negativists. I think a lot of it has to do, I've given there's a new disease. I call it the David Susskind syndrome. Remember David? He was a talk show host on television many years ago. In the early 70s, he called me in California. They brought me to New York. He wanted me to find him a good abductee. I got him Betty Hill, a good skeptic. Well, there aren't any, but here's how to reach Phil Klass. And they wanted me to send a bunch of stuff. And I did all that stuff. They brought me to New York, stayed over one night. In the course of taping segments for the show, I had some good people on. He says, off air, you know, I read the New York Times. There's nothing there that says these things are real. So I defined it as the David Susskind syndrome. First, I take great pride in keeping up on what's really important in the world. That's my job. If it's important, I know about it. If aliens were visiting and the government was covering it up, that would be important. Everybody grants that. But if it were true, I would know about it, and I don't, so it must not be. And I'm not going to waste my time finding out about this non-existent subject. And so I find that with people, with the ancient academics and fossilized physicists, as I call them, that they haven't done their homework. They're not willing to do their homework. They're totally unaware. And they really say some stupid things. I did a radio talk show debate coast to coast with Dr. Michael Shermer, head of the Skeptics Society. 3 hours. We had been on one of those Larry King shows, and then he'd been on with George Norrie before, so he set it up. And he starts off by saying, look, the explanation is very straightforward. For all these crazy, strange phenomena, there's a residue effect. 5% can't be identified, whatever it is, just because there isn't enough data. Boy, that gave me a hole I could drive a truck through. So I did. I pointed out Blue Book Special Report 14, you know, 21.5%. The Condon Report, 30%, according to a subcommittee of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. Dick Hall's The UFO Evidence, 17%. And it was downhill for them. We took a vote at the end. I got 80% of the vote. He didn't know anything.
Wow.
Now, when I was on with Seth Shostak, who's a more personable guy, we had met on the Queen Elizabeth II. We each gave three lectures on its last westward voyage from Southampton, kind of a kick. But anyway, when I gave my lecture, I asked again who had read this, that, and the other thing, and he didn't raise his hand for anything. So I won that debate, too. It was 57, 34... and 9, I guess that adds up.
Nine unknown or nine undecided, you mean?
Undecided, yeah. And I'm waiting now. Now, I must admit that many months, years later, I had contacted Seth and asked if I could send him a copy of my book, Flying Saucers in Science, and he said yes. So on the radio, he got asked, and he did have a copy of my book on his nightstand. He hadn't read it.
Yeah.
But that's the problem. You get the SETI people saying there is no evidence for UFOs. Mm-hmm. They never refer to any of these five large-scale scientific studies. And the crazy thing is, SETI has provided not one whit of evidence that there's anybody out there sending radio signals to us. Not a bet. We're supposed to take that at, in faith, I guess. And, you know, like I said, why would they do that? Everybody knows that Columbus didn't send smoke signals to the natives, did he?
Well, the irony of this would be is if, you know, a small part of the government, as you say, may have known since 1947, why SETI would come into existence to begin with.
Well, because there are people who want research grants. It sounds glorious. Carl Sagan was a big proponent of SETI. Carl and I went to University of Chicago at the same time, spent 3 years in the same classes. And in his congressional testimony, well, in several places, he has said there are interesting sightings that aren't reliable, there are reliable sightings that aren't interesting, but there are no interesting and reliable sightings. No reference is given for this totally false claim. Because in Blue Book Special Report 14, they evaluated reliability, and they found the more reliable the sighting, the more likely to be unexplainable. Hmm. But nobody except me pointed that out. So the SETI community has a serious problem with UFOs, and with an understanding of how society works. That's not their long suit. There was one guy who says, you know, aliens could determine that our CO2 level has increased on this planet. They may be very perturbed about that. And I'm sitting there, what? You know, this is a society that has exploded 2,000 nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
2,000. Only two of them on people, fortunately. I'm very grateful.
Yeah.
But in terms of the larger scheme of things in a local neighborhood, there are two implications of that. One is that you could build a propulsion system using nuclear energy, which is true. We have, incidentally, just for kicks, we have aircraft carriers that nuclear fission that can operate for 18 years without refueling.
Amazing.
That's very impressive to me. Hmm. Now, the second implication of that is that we're obviously a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Nobody out there would want us out there. Of course, they got to keep tabs on the idiots here.
Yeah, the virus, as someone put it. We're like the virus. They don't want us out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe we're a penal colony. They dumped all the bad boys and girls here, and that's why we're so nasty to each other. When you go to Australia, incidentally, they take great pride in their convict ancestors.
That's right. Hey, Stan, I mentioned this on a previous podcast, and I don't want to belabor the fact, but I did speak with someone years ago that was supposedly involved in Vietnam and studying UFOs for the government, and he was my insurance agent. And his thing that he said is that the government's concluded that we're a petri dish. And have you ever heard anything like that before?
I kind of like that analogy. No.
Hmm.
Whereas Fleming discovered penicillin that way, kind of, by seeing some strange things happen. Who knows? I mean, in my book, Flying Saucers and Science, there's a whole chapter on the why questions. There's a piece on my website, too. You know, why would aliens come here? I think I give 22, maybe 23, I don't know, reasons for coming here. They're broadcasters of the weekly show, Idiocy in the Boondocks. You know, it's the honeymoon capital of this corner of the galaxy. You know, they're being punished. Spent 2 weeks near Earth, boy. You better get your next assignment right. You know? But let's be a little more pragmatic. It turns out the Earth is the densest planet in the solar system. I don't mean the people. I mean, which comes for two. A cubic foot of Earth weighs more than a cubic foot of any other planet in our solar system.
Hmm.
And the normal response is, so what, Stan? Well, that means we got more very heavy metals. Things like uranium, gold, tungsten, rhenium, platinum. People think heavy as lead. Well, osmium is twice as heavy as lead. And these are rare in the universe. They have very special properties. So they may have been mining them, for all we know. And one reason they don't want us to have a nuclear war is we'd make it hard for them to do their mining, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we're the only planet that's covered with water at this time. Well, three-quarters of it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottom of the oceans have all kinds of goodies, nodules and stuff that readily mined.
Right.
And we have over 1,000 reports of UFOs unidentified submerged objects.
Yeah, which is amazing. Well, I mean, if they can do what they do anyway. You know, one of the people that you debated was Dr. John Alexander, I believe it was.
And that was a crazy debate.
Yeah. The moderator was throwing questions. I guess he was a lawyer. But one of the things I liked what John said was, I don't think we know what type of questions to ask. And it was something that kind of made sense to me.
Well, yeah, that was a crazy debate. I found out that I was going to do that 2 minutes beforehand.
Oh, no.
It was supposed to be somebody else, Steve Bassett, and I was there, and I had given a lecture, and I had a vendor's table and stuff, and somebody comes rushing, Stan, we need you. What for? Well, to debate John. Well, isn't Steve doing that? Well, he can't make it. He's got some kind of a transportation problem. We need you right now. Okay, I had read John's book. I had heard him on Coast to Coast the night or two nights before, maybe. And so I was willing to take him on because he made a lot of mistakes in his book, and I was ready to point those out. And, you know, he's come up. He's the ultimate insider. He worked on all kinds of classified programs, had high-level clearances. And he says he and his buddies checked all around Washington thinking that they'd find the secret group that was doing the important stuff. They couldn't find anybody, so there must not be any such group, and Roswell probably didn't happen, and no MJ-12. And, you know, I tried, folks, and I had to point out a lot of things wrong. What he said in his book, he got the facts wrong about MJ-12 and a lot of other things. It was a strange debate. I should look at the... I have a video, I guess, a DVD of that. But the moderator did most of the control of everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He was really pushing him. Well, Stan, thank you so much. You'll be back for part two. I really appreciate it. And thank you so much for joining us today. This has been great.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Great.